Thank you for listening to this talk, produced by the Art Gallery of South Australia.
What a wonderful, attentive audience we have here at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Saturday. I know it's all the art geeks and enthusiasts, so you know it's wonderful to have you all here and to have so many visitors from interstate as well, the ambassadors, CCB groups from Art Gallery New South Wales, artists, colleagues from all over the country. And I'd like to acknowledge that we're gathering here on Kaurna country to say Namarni to everyone and to pay our respects to the traditional owners of Kaurna country of Tantania, where we're meeting today. My name is Lee Robb. I'm the Curator of Contemporary Art here at the Art Gallery of South Australia. And it is my immense pleasure to be joined by this trifecta of extraordinarily talented artists. So we're joined today by Jess Lachlan, who is from, or also from Adelaide. I guess we're now from Adelaide, aren't we? Jess Lachlan, Lillian O'Neill, and Teela George. So today I think we're going to be delving into the reaches of the sublime, of the ephemeral, thinking about materiality and temporality across textiles, across photo collage, and across glass. So we thought we might start, because we're dealing in some esoteric territory in some cases, thought we might begin by talking to each of the artists about where they work and what they work with, and then we'll unpack some of the details of the works that have been made for Jose da Silva's extraordinary Inner Sanctum for this very, very fine and sophisticated Adelaide Biennial of Australian Art. But Teela said that she would kick things off.
Hello.
Thanks,
Hi,
Teela.
Everyone. My name's Teela George and I am based in Melbourne, although I am from Perth originally. And I work mostly with thread embroidery and with bronze at the moment, although I do consider materials the foundation of how I move through and think about things, so that changes from time to time. But yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
Very succinct. And then it's going to take us the next hour to unpack all of that.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a great beginning. Thanks, Teela. Lillian, how about you?
I work at home at the moment in my studio garage in Torquay, which is where I grew up. I've come back after a long time away, but and I make large-scale photo montages, which involves a huge amount of collecting pre-digital photography and books that I find in op shops and book fairs all over the place. I go through them and kind of intuitively rip them out and scan and assemble them.
And scale them up?
Scale, yeah, is really important. and I work on the computer to do that, but also the floor to move around images. Yeah.
It's a very physical process. So is Jess's process.
Yeah. I work in glass. But I actually think I work in glass and light, and that's what's so beautiful about glass is it's a holder of light. And so I use it and think about it a lot in terms of manipulating light. And I work here in South Australia, 5 minutes down the road. Actually, weirdly, I never thought that I would be working in an old church. And so, which says God is love and God is light on the wall. but what's beautiful about the space, and I think spaces dictate often your work, is we have these really tall windows with light shafts coming into the space that, of course, change at different times of the day. But I am originally from Melbourne. I studied at Canberra School of Art that had a fantastic glass program there, and it was fantastic because of the time spent with the material. So my practice is very much very embedded in my relationship with the material glass and the techniques and really understanding that making process. And then I moved partly to South Australia because of my love of light, the desert, the harshness of the light, the changing the light and the landscape that we have here up north. And that was over 25 years ago, so I am a South Australian.
It's official. You heard it here. So light and the landscape and the time either spent inside or outdoors is kind of runs through all of your practices. But I think since we're talking about sort of site specificity with the work that you've made, Jess, which is upstairs, well, it's right behind us actually, and it's an extraordinary piece made here for the gallery, a large ocular, a circular piece, also made with the late and very, very great and very dear Kai Lu, and it's called Solari. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about that title?
Well, I think just in terms of the start in coming to this project, Jose da Silva said, you always talk about needing light change in your work and the observation of light change. And so I found a space for you in the gallery that we've opened up that is a big western window. And could you do something here? And apart from being horrified at the start and nervous and I can't do it, and that is a lot of light, then the opportunity to work with the sun in such a direct way, you know, was exciting. And it was it's a round, and I have worked in round, but never of that kind of scale. I've always liked working in more rectangular forms because I like the idea of I very much like space, and I like the idea that it's never ending. And when you see a rectangle on a wall, it doesn't have borders. As soon as you've got a round on a wall, you've got a border. Mm. But for this space, it almost dictated the round. And then once I'm working with the round, I'm working with light, I'm working with the sun. So Solari is a word that I came to as the Italian meaning of it is like a hole in the sky for the sun to shine through onto the earth. And I thought that was a beautiful feeling about letting the sun to shine through this hole into the gallery space. But also it has a Latin relationship with not solitude.
Solace.
Thank you. There's the nerves. solace. And that alluded to the emotion that I'm interested in, or the space that I'm interested in creating in all of my work, a relationship to a comfort in the quiet. And then during the process, it became even more powerful because the collaborator I was working with, Kai Lu, passed away. And so this piece then took on another meaning for me, for the piece, and for the location as well.
Yeah, it's a very, very special work, and it becomes doubly significant as a result. Talking about... I just want to stay with you a little bit longer and talk about the process of making and getting there, and then I want to open it up a bit more to Lillian and Tila. But I think when people see your work and they encounter it, it's engaging in the currency of the sublime, and there's something kind of extraordinary about how you know, how it does, how light passes through it, but how light is constantly changing in that space, and you've used light and the sun as a material. But to physically make it, you engaged water as well. And maybe if you can talk through that, because it's a very specific kind of process that not many people know how to do or understand how you've managed to harness those glass particles and water.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's not a conventional glass process either. And I do a lot of conventional glass processes that are highly technical in some of my work. But this process is a little bit more experimental and a little bit more freeing in some ways that I needed to have in my practice. And so what I start off with is a large sheet of low iron float glass that then I blast the surface of it to create a tooth with a sandblaster. And then I grind up white glass that is like I make into a block and grind it up and create a slurry, almost like milk, of white glass that I mix with water. And then I put the glass on a large table, and then I actually use a hose like my brush to move the surface, move the white powder across the surface of the glass. And this process is quite... it's quite quick, it's not laboured, and there is that space that I have to get into before starting that first stroke, which is quite a meditative space. So often I would do all the preparation, have all the materials in place, even listen to a certain sort of music, like Avo Pair is one of my favourite pieces, to get into the zone before making that stroke, because it's about the connection almost between the body and the material, not the head. And so I don't want my work so much to be about thought or intellect. And then I would do that multiple times until I get what I want. And then I leave the work out so that all the water dries and it evaporates. And then the piece goes on into a large kiln. The kiln size is the exact size of the piece upstairs. I pushed the boundaries.
I was going to ask about that.
How big can I go? And then the white powder fuses on to the sheet glass, which is called kiln-formed glass. Mm. But it's not super shiny, it's just kind of what we call tack fused onto the surface. And then I'd go back and do another kind of layer. And some of these processes of evaporation, of mark making, for me, the memory of water as well, visibility, invisibility in terms of the cycles of water, relate a little to the landscape I'm very inspired by, which is Northern South Australia, particularly around the Salt Lakes, Katitanda, Lake Gairdner, where when you're in those landscapes, there's such a strong feeling of the memory of water in those landscapes. It's like an absence of water where you're travelling along and you go through the divots of all those drainage lines. And of course, with Katitanda, you're very aware of water travel, how long it has to travel, how much of that water gets evaporated into air and then cloud. And so those senses of time and distance in that kind of large landscape relate a little bit, and the mark making and the evaporation. You can see some of the evaporation lines within the work upstairs around that white powdered glass, and those kind of marks kind of relate to that inspiration.
It's phenomenal. It literally is phenomenal. Coming from everyone feels like clapping. Yeah. Well, it is. It's an extraordinary achievement to be able to transform heat and light and water into such a significant piece that. That really holds the space, but also I think the meditative state, and I guess that the zone of the inner sanctum is what you've created and gifted and created as an offering for all of us and for the gallery. Thinking about the sky and light and harnessing light in different ways, but through completely opposite materials is interesting to think about your work, Teela, and also, like you said, the painterly underpinnings of your practice, but also the painterly underpinnings in yours as well, which think about colour and light and the vastness of the sky. And how I love how artists always deal in, you know, the impossible. How do you visualise the impossible, or how do you pin it down?
Yeah, true. Yeah, so I was very fortunate to be given the opportunity to show my ongoing series of sky piece works. Jose and I were both very excited about doing this, and I haven't really put them all together before in the past. And so this series really represents for me this kind of impossible pursuit to try to render the sky, which is omnipresent and completely immaterial and also strangely familiar. We see it every day, even just in the periphery of our eyes, into the most material, everyday, kind of basic, familiar thing, which is thread. So the works that I have here have been made. I started in 2017, the first one, which is on the wall facing that way, with the little rings. That one was for Primavera in 2017, and I kind of came to this notion of the sky and my Sisyphean effort to represent it through my love of archives and collections. I'm really interested in our will to keep and make things and the inherent kind of material vulnerabilities within that context. So I'm always rummaging through collections and archives and asking lovely curators to let me behind the scenes to see what I can dig up or find. And in this case, it was when I was living in Perth, and I was going through the WA Library archives, and I was obsessed with unedited, remembered memoirs, and I found these beautiful oral histories that were like a portal of time. They were made in like the 60s by someone who was elderly, remembering growing up in the country before we had all these technologies. And I was listening to it a few years ago in 2017 through these new technologies through a digital platform. And I just thought that was a beautiful window into the past and represented like what these sorts of things that we keep and value can do, you know, over time. So, you know, me just imagining this woman like washing her clothes in a bucket, which is what she was talking about. It was very, some people might say boring, but I loved it. It was riveting for me, but so descriptive. And I just kept imagining like this scene with this beautiful sky and the landscape, and this sky became this connecting through line for me. And I was thinking more and more about how can I materialise that? What does that mean? And I, yeah, have ever since always been working on a sky piece. Unfortunately, there are a couple that we couldn't include in this showing. I don't know how we would have fit them in, to be honest, but it just kind of represents that pursuit that I will continue to do until these guys don't work anymore. So that's my plan. And, yeah, it's like a backbone of my practice and the way I think about materiality and the material hierarchies between something like fabric, which is very volatile and ephemeral, and something like bronze, which is quite the opposite, and kind of bringing those two together in this more empathetic, handmade way. So, yeah, sky.
It's vast terrain.
It is, yeah, it's impossible. I don't know what I'm doing, but yeah, obsessed.
I think you clearly do. But thinking, like you said, about trying to materialise the sky or something impossible or the changing nature of the sky, coming to you, Lillian, you've created an extraordinary body of photo montages.
Thank you.
And also thinking about time and history in the archive and how you might materialise the crepuscular, which was a word that you used yesterday, which is a way to describe, you know, that light sort of at the very end of the day.
The evening, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess in my work, the sky and light shifts through each piece when Jose very beautifully asked me to be part of this show. He came with so much vulnerability and so much openness that I felt very supported to be likewise. At the time, I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. So I was awake all the time.
She hasn't slept for 3 years.
That's not far from the truth. But yeah, and so I was experiencing like an even handedness of daylight and night time, and breastfeeding constantly, and observing the shifts in the day and the night, relating to the moon in a very emotional way, and like feeling time. And so I started to think about what I might make, and searching through my archive of found photographs for the shifts in light, and trying to see if I could find almost fragments of duration of light changing, and in kind of include them in a whole, kind of bring them together. And it was a process of puzzling them together, finding and taking away, and exploring photography that way. And then putting figures into that was quite tricky, but that was definitely the start point. So it's, we all have the sky as something we've spent a lot of time wondering about. Yeah.
And you, and the relationship between the body and I guess the senses as well. And you were talking about that very almost like we have an extra guest who's who is transfixed by our conversation. Someone who really needs a stage. Okay. I think that's beautiful. It's come from the sky to join us.
Disney princesses.
Yeah. But you talked about the term, is it matrescence?
Matrescence.
Matrescence,
yeah.
As that's a state of, that of becoming a mother?
The very early stages of motherhood, and I guess becoming a new version, accepting motherhood as a part of your identity, which, yeah, I sort of... I was reading the other day about this social psychology model of identity change, and that we all kind of experience every 10 years or sort of like over a long time, but there are these dramatic environments that can make it happen really quickly. Mm. It's like, you know, being kidnapped, natural disaster. I think you know where I'm going with this. But and motherhood. and, yeah, the sort of split or rupture in identity that happens when you go through something so extreme. But
it fundamentally changes the way you see things and see the world.
Yeah, exactly. You have no reference point for your old identity, so you have to switch really fast, and your reference points become your new self. But and like the split that happened was such a fragmentation of self. I saw motherhood as like something outside of myself, and I think matrescence is about merging. And I tried to kind of tackle that in the work, this feeling of dissolving, reforming, becoming part of your domestic situation, and finding, you know, the difficulty of that, but also the new relationships you have with things like light or your your home and love.
And I think because Lillian's work is on the cover of the biennial catalogue, which would be the perfect time to show you and tell you that it's in the bookshop. But on the cover, one of the main images or one of the large major works sort of anchoring that group of photo montages downstairs features a sort of slumped woman or a lot of it there feels like there's this very, very slow movement or sort of slipping between the architecture. There's glances of light coming through and there's a lot of horizontal windows and ledges and edges, and it's this relationship between the hard edge of the environment and then the contour of the body, and that almost almost becoming one with your interior, which is something that you said you had this this extended experience of sort of becoming one with your environment, with your child, with your partner, and completely sort of changed state, and that, but also finding images. I was curious about finding images that are historic, ancient, also about women in those different states, and trying to find imagery to represent that. So it's it's a really significant undertaking that you're doing, which is personal and universal.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, a part of it as well was sleep deprivation made me like hallucinate, and so I literally couldn't feel the edges of things. Like pick a lemon, it's like over there. But, but yeah, there was. I definitely. I mean, on a more positive note, I felt like sublimely connected to other people that had experienced this, and that the strength of having those experiences behind me was real. It felt very like goddess-like or something, don't have a god delusion, but yeah.
It's so weird because for me, like I think our work is extremely different, but when you talk about the blur between your exterior space and your internal space, which I see in your work as well, it's almost like the bodies are embedded in that landscape and in in that interior and dissolving. It's something that is a question for me in my work as well.
Like, I felt that with yours when I saw it yesterday.
Why I'm in this space when I'm in such a large space, and maybe it is also extreme, like, Northern Australia is an extreme space, and so there is a danger, or sublime is sublime,
yeah,
has
a
danger about it because of the vastness, the never ending, the danger as well.
The fear of losing yourself in it. Yeah.
And it's so big that you do lose yourself, but you kind of, you don't really lose yourself because you're so aware of the self in that space, but when I'm in that space, it's that coming together and the blur, it becomes very blurry between the body and the space.
When I saw your work yesterday, I felt it bodily. The light, it was a bodily feeling rather than like you say.
It makes me think of a phrase that James Turrell, the artist, uses, who works with sky spaces and light spaces, and he describes it as or creating work where what you experience is a dilation of the senses, and that idea of both the dilation, in an optical sense, but also the dilation of all of your senses, like this heightened experience of your body, of seeing, hearing, touching, feeling, and I think that's what each of you are doing in your work. It's this dilation of the senses, both in the making of it and then I think in the receiving of it or the experiencing of it for us as audiences as well.
I mean, it's very, very much my aim to do that. I mean, one other thing he said is, James Turrell, that is, who works with light, is that I'm more interested in your seeing than my seeing, as in terms of the viewer, the person, and that's very... very true to what I'm trying to do. I don't want my work to speak at you. I don't want it to say something. I'm trying to create a space for you to listen to yourselves And that, of course, you know, relates to that contemplative space, but also connection, connection between your environment and yourself, and understanding that relationship.
Yeah, because, Tila, if we come back to your work as well, there's that sense that you're making it in the environment, and I don't know, there was one of the works that we're very lucky to have in our collection, the Art Gallery of South Australia, which is the one with little, with edges of orange on the bottom and the top of the work, and that was in Cottesloe, which is a place that we both know, the west coast and the sunset on the west coast, and it feels like you just really conjure that that feeling of that recurring sunset of, you know, it's one here we can also experience the sun setting over the west coast compared to the east coast, which is about sunrise, but the sky pieces are an extended exploration of the sky, and I guess just where you're making and how you're making, and I'm always fascinated because I know you when you began as a painter and then the shift into embroidery.
I mean, honestly, I think they're more like paintings that use thread. Like, I use a similar approach. It's very intuitive. I mean, they were kind of born originally, this technique of using linen to embroider out of offcuts of old paintings, and I'd, like, blanket stitch them together and then, you know, was really kind of inspired by that that kind of process of evolving this composition. And they're very forgiving. I can, like, hate on something and cut it out and rework it, and that's the way I would paint as well. It's just one's fast motion and one's extremely slow motion comparatively. So I'm sure you can guess which is which. But, yeah, so the embroideries were kind of born out of, like, almost cannibalising materials in my practice kind of playing with composition and how that would happen without a design, just with, like, an idea of potentially weight or, you know, example here of the sky pieces, you know, always in pursuit of that sky blue, which is impossible, and I know that. I also know it's impossible to represent the sky in its entirety. I know that, but I just think there's a certain romance to the pursuit. But, yeah, so, I mean, it is a very intense kind of hands-on process of embroidering and stepping back and cutting out. I have a very regimented studio regime, which maybe I'm too embarrassed to share, but it involves taking breaks. I have to go for walks, do Pilates, whatever, so that I can really get back into it. It's just about kind of that repetition of labour and time and accumulation of this surface. For example, with the Cottesloe work, it was actually in COVID times when I made that. I was... Unfortunately, I'm from Victoria, so we were very locked in and no one could go to their studios, including me. But I live in an old house on Smith Street that has this crazy dungeon underneath, or cellar. I like dungeon. But so me and my housemate, we're both artists, we were able to activate that space, and I literally made this almost longing piece of seeing the sunset in Cottesloe, and I couldn't go to Perth, which was very frustrating for me. And I was in a windowless dungeon making this piece about light and being outside and going to a place where I couldn't go. So it's very much... That one specifically is about this specific longing. Because usually what I do is take these pieces with me when I travel, which is... You might see some of them will have names of different cities. And they're perfect travel companions. I do have some with me now, just so you know. So just that idea of bringing it with me and embedding that within the process of the making and the time and where I am and is very much part of it. But Cottesloe is the one that's a cheat because I never was in Cottesloe when I made that one. I was in the dungeon.
But I love that it's a perfect picture of longing.
No. The first one I made was the one on this wall with the little rings.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I'm interested in, you know, how you take care of your body as an artist when you're making these works that are very physically demanding, and especially with the repetition of sewing, and sometimes those are the things that are not asked. You know, how do you, you know, you're doing an extended endurance performance about trying to represent the sky through thread, and that means that if you want to keep doing that, you also have to... you know, stay nimble.
Well, this is a great little plug for Pilates, actually. So, like, when I was in Perth, I was doing a large-scale work and I was sitting in the worst chair ever. It was like a kind of 50s, like plastic laminate sort of. It was just not good, not ergonomically correct. And I was sitting like this as well, which is apparently also bad. But I was just all of a sudden woke up and I had like an inflamed disc. I've never had any issues before and it was horrible. I couldn't move. And so since then I've learnt my lesson. I've got myself a nice chair and I go to Pilates every day as like a little breakup. It's like something that's definitely part of the work. It is an endurance. It's like not meditative. People think of my fee. I'm obsessed. So that's gives you some idea, but like it's very like can be very frustrating and but also extraordinarily rewarding. Like I always am compelled to see what the work's going to say to me at the end. So I just do what I'm told and
the work
hope,
tells you what.
Cross my fingers.
It sounds incredibly like this duality between the repetitiveness, yeah. which I have a little bit in some of my process,
yeah.
but also that kind of dare I say anxiety with finishing it, but then also I know you work intuitively as well. Like.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. After a while of just kind of exploring this process and asking the work questions and like researching different things, you just become acclimated to this weird like balance between anxiety and the desire to like or to do this thing. Yeah.
I wear a kickboxing outfit in the studio.
Kickboxing?
Yeah, because I work on the floor. So
oh,
I have like
oh
pads.
So you have like knee pads
yeah.
and elbow pads.
Yeah. And like shin pads and feet pads.
That's so smart.
Well, because scale is really... Well, because like I was going to ask about surfing because I know that you're a surfer as well and you live in Torquay, but while you were making a lot of the works, you were in rural Victoria. But the space of the studio as the inner sanctum, I think, is something that comes through a lot in this biennial. And, I think everyone is curious to know how you do make these massive collages, because collage is often something that's handmade and you're using things that come from magazines and books which have a certain size, but then you're scanning them and scaling them up, and that's why you can't... They're anachronistic. They sit outside of time because of the way that you're putting these things together, which seems sort of a perfect conduit to think about your work, but then it's so physical to make them. I love... We've got a... get some video of that.
Yeah. I'm here.
That's
yeah, well, I was lucky enough actually to have, during COVID, an amazing studio in Geelong, the old courthouse. It wasn't in use because it's mostly for theatre. And I got the entire place, 20 metres, 10 metres, every room. I was it was incredible. So I could work on a lot of works at once in this empty, quite spooky... courthouse.
Do you think that's also why you scaled up more? Do you think it was related to that, or you'd always wanted to be you wanted to be
I
working
like the,
at that
like body to body relationship?
Yeah, you can feel that.
Yeah, and in terms of time, I think the kind of obsolescence, I guess, of found photography versus like the generative nature of the internet and digital imagery. And I love how it kind of relates to our own sense of mortality of time passing. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's embedded in found photography, pre-digital. Yeah.
It's kind of interesting thinking about the relationship between that and this new technology that generates its own images, you know, without any assistance. Like there's something really...
You mean like AI?
Yeah.
The other robot, not me. AI is I don't know.
But I think that sort of pushing against that deliberately, but also engaging with histories of collage, of data, of, there's... now I know there's a whole different performative element to your work now, a full-body engagement, which is...
I also really like the craft movement, like the Victorian craft movement. I was looking at some collages there and they're so subversive and weird. I found one that was a woman had cut all the heads off a portrait of society women and hung them on hook hats and then just put herself as a full person going like this.
And when was this made? When was it? What time?
Like 19th century.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
wow.
So, yeah. Victorian craft movement. Wow. The women making collages then were pretty out there. Wow. Yeah. Huh. But I love that about collage. It is. It's funny. It's subversive. Mm-hmm. It's often political and. Yeah,
it just comes from,
you know, yeah, it's so immediate, yeah.
So there are other artists, collage artists that have inspired you over time?
I really like the artist Bhatia Sutta at the moment. I love her collections of found images and how that kind of, she's working in a very archival but also that tradition of the atlas or the encyclopedia of found images, going back to like Abi Warburg, and then like Gerhard Richter's Atlas and Bhatia Sutta, and even Patrick Pound, I guess.
Yeah, you can see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's lovely conversations, I think, with modernism, but then it feels like you're being deliberately subversive in how you're making them and how you're also imagining the female body in that space.
You're finding the personal in the impersonal. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So thinking about senses and temperature and heat, it's really warm up here, and we're all like, you know, quietly perspiring, and I'm very impressed.
Lillian's
particularly
ready.
You. Luckily, you're in so maybe move out of the sun a little bit, but it's probably the and just as we said that a breeze passes through, but I thought we'd open it up to some questions because now's the time when we have these extraordinary artist with us here to open it up to the crowd. So I'm going to let you have a little think, but I know that Barbara Flynn will have a question. No, I'm not going to put you on the spot. But we can also just keep talking amongst ourselves because we had some really beautiful conversations yesterday. And also to have artists asking each other questions around how you make, what you make, why you make, and why you've made what you have for the biennial right now is, it's such a gift to be able to have these conversations and understand the work on so many different levels because you've all made profound contributions. It's such a good biennial. How good is this biennial? Can we just say a big round of applause for Jose? It's definitely a journey across materials and the senses, and you know you've made it such an exquisite experience for everyone, and brought out given incredible challenges to each of the artists, and made it in a supportive environment. And I think that's something that the Biennial can do, and very astute, brilliant curators can do. And so it's a treat and a pleasure to have you all in the gallery over this time, and hopefully a permanent installation, which speaks wonderfully to the Christian Waller, and talking about spirituality as well, and getting into that space.
It is pretty. I mean, I've never seen my work in such a spiritual setting, actually, especially amongst the other works upstairs, not just the Waller, but the Indigenous work, Islamic work, references to Catholicism and Greek Orthodox, which if someone told me that beforehand, I would have just gone, no way. But I've never really thought of my work in that way. But what was interesting is once I came across the round and went, right, this work has to be held in space, which is when I just rang Kai and said, would you help me out? And he said, yes. And I said, I haven't told you what the project is yet. But we've worked on a number of projects over my career. Not many, but over my whole career. But, went to looking at Zen temples in Kyoto, and
I was wondering about Zen Buddhism,
and I haven't really. I mean, there's sensitivities to relationships to Zen Buddhism that relate to my work and what I'm thinking about, but I am not studied in that at all. But it was interesting that then that happened, and that relationship to that space and the circle being a representation of enlightenment in those spaces, and creating a space for an opportunity for enlightenment, because getting into that headspace to be open for inspiration is something that I'm very interested in my work. But even you have to do as an artist as well. Like, how do I work as an artist? There's the materiality of physically making the work, but then where do the ideas come from? And how do they come? So having a practice that includes certain sort of activities that you do that allow inspiration, allow ideas to come. And, you know, part of that for me is being quiet, but other parts are even really like yoga, surprise, surprise, but walking, but also the process of repetition work within grinding surfaces of glass and how long that takes, and it's with your hands and it's very connected and the body is occupied, so you don't tend to ruminate so much. So because the body is occupied, then there is space for inspiration. So, sorry, I've just started going on a tangent there. I was going back, you know, that I'm surprised, but this project has surprised me in a few ways, and that connection and placed in quite a spiritual setting in an art gallery was one of them.
Well, I think on that note, you're going to be left with plenty of opportunities for enlightenment, which is a very, very beautiful way of putting it. And I think on that note, if there are no questions, unless you want to quietly come and have questions with the artists afterwards, which I'm sure... Oh, see, Barbara Flynn, put your hand up. Get excellent. Do we need a microphone, or I can just repeat it?
I have... Whoa. I've been thinking the whole time about the idea of the window. And I think it might be implicit in the work of the three artists. I wondered if you could speak to that.
Absolutely. Well, that's a great point, because the idea of portals has always been something that I've been fascinated in. And I, like I said previously, do a lot of research in archives and collections. And that's kind of where I started to see that idea of the window or the portal, or these, you know, artworks or objects that we keep being a way to activate that. I mean, my work here kind of explicitly speaks of the window, I think, especially in this space where, you know, there are windows there that have been kind of covered, but then we have these sky pieces that represent exactly that. But yeah, I see the idea of the portal or the window within all art objects. We can bring them out and relate them to other objects through time and create different conversations. So for me, that's a really fundamental way of looking at that sort of content I'm making as well.
As artists, we are, dare I say. For me, it seems to be about framing. And one thing that I need to be strong about as well is I'm very influenced by the landscape here, but I know little about it, and I'm very much aware of that. And so I see my work more about space, and I see those landscapes almost abstracted for me because I don't have the history to understand them. So I'm trying to tread very lightly with them. But I'm framing something. I'm framing what I bring to looking at those spaces. And, you know, and classically we know with those very photographic type of landscapes, you can frame the landscape to create something, and then just out of frame is the heap of other tourists that are there on the side doing whatever, plus the flies, plus the heat, plus the extremeness. You know, it's all of so many elements are about the actual place, but so, you know, of course, a window and framing an experience, or framing one thing that comes from it, not a representation.
I think when you were asking that question, like COVID just being in lockdown really popped into my mind, and sort of being forced to sit in your domestic space and look out instead of being out, and even an extra layer of self as a window inside to outside. And certainly, like, having babies during that time, seeing, like, I was talking about the sky, but it was all through the windows in my house. And I think that is in the work. I haven't made smaller works very often, and the two smaller ones are sort of domestic window sized. Yeah.
Beautiful. So a view through the window or into other spaces. I think Jose put it very beautifully in his incredible catalogue when he was writing about all of your works around how they are a synthesis of space, of atmosphere, and of your own presence, and that that it's also around an intense surrender where the self dissolves, as it were, into air, which Julie Ewington also used as a way to describe your work. And I think you know, what you've all achieved is really astonishing, personal, universal, and truly sublime. And now with all of that, I'm sure you'll go and have a different kind of encounter with the works in the space after that. And into the future. But just want to say an enormous thank you to all of you, to Jess, to Lily, and to Tila, and to you as a very, very attentive and wonderful audience. So thank you so much. Round of applause.
Thank you.